Bob Woodward, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You know, it's been 40 years, almost 40 years, since the Watergate break-in and cover-up. It's hard to overemphasize its influence on our culture and politics. After all, every political scandal in the English-speaking world has a gate appended to it. But how much influence has it had on what politicians and their surrogates do and are willing to do?
Well, that depends on who the politicians are. I think a number of them kind of understood the lesson that transparency works. You've got to explain what you're doing and can't cut corners, and law-breaking doesn't work. Obviously, there are other politicians and others like on Wall Street and elsewhere who have not absorbed that message and believe that cutting corners and breaking the law and concealing, covering up will work and you won't get caught. Like so many things, I think it's a mixed bag.
How about how they react to malfeasance? Because that was, you know, as we know, this is what got President Nixon. It was not necessarily the break-in, it was the cover-up.
It certainly was, and if you look at Bill Clinton's problems, I think any neutral examination would show if early on, after he was elected president or even before, if he had put out all the boxes of documents about the Whitewater investigation he and his wife Hillary made, that people would have gone through it, there would have been some questions, they would have taken some hits, but there wouldn't have been the special counsel, the independent counsel, that hounded him for so many years and then discovered not really wrongdoing on Whitewater, but discovered a woman named Monica Lewinsky, which led to that scandal and Clinton's impeachment and eventual acquittal in the Senate, in a Senate trial. But nonetheless, if you chart that and you say, you know, what happened here, what happened there is the failure to understand the necessity of kind of coming clean. Hey, look, this is what happened. This is what we did. Had that occurred, there would have been no impeachment of Bill Clinton, quite clearly, at least on those issues, or on the issue of Monica Lewinsky and the perjury that he involved himself in.
You've talked to an awful lot of policymakers and politicians over the years. How difficult is it to actually come clean on a minor point? Because it seems like the way our political culture is, there seems to be a genuine fear that even a minor point is going to be blown out of proportion, and they fear having see that made public.
Yes, and that's exactly the right question. And coming clean is emotionally very difficult. But in a legal sense, in terms of American politics, most of the time people come clean, it just goes away. It is when you get into the legal system and there are investigations in Congress or by the Justice Department or independent counsels, which we don't have anymore, that law has expired. But when you get tangled in the law, then you are in trouble or in potential trouble. And that's what you have to avoid if you're going to protect yourself. But, you know, lots of people aren't willing to take the hit and say, oh, this will not come out. No one's going to find out. Well, I've done this for 40 years now, and one of the things the wisest people say, nothing is secret. Nothing will be hidden. Now, of course, there are many secrets and much is hidden, but if you operate on the premise that it won't work, that it's going to come out, then your response is going to be very different. And there's a kind of moral dimension to this, that if you're in politics, you kind of have a duty to explain who you are and come clean. I think where we are now, we have a lot of coming clean, and certainly too little of it. And there are a lot of people I know and have dealt with, and, you know, I've had people come and cry because they got caught in something and feel immense remorse because of it.
Well, there seems to be two sort of separate waves. One where you see a person who steps up and says, yes, there's been a transgression. Sometimes they'll either freely admit it, they'll try to move on. Other times they resign and leave. The other side seems to be, well, yes, this happened, and very little shame about I'm going to go on with my life.
Working. It depends, yeah. Obviously. But I think in the end, a scandal like Watergate and the system eventually working, and that's what my partner, Carl Bernstein, and I are going to talk about when we're there, the system actually functioned quite well, and we're going to go through and attempt to explain that. I think it was, you know, it's good that people who have power realize that there is accountability, that people are going to say, well, wait a minute, who are you? How did you do that? What does it mean? Again, you have to come clean.
Well, take us back to the days after June 17th, 1972. There's a, you know, you first reported there was a break-in at the DNC. Did you have any sense of its importance at the time?
Well, it was a nice Saturday morning. The editor sat around and said, who would be crazy enough to come in for work on a day like this? I'd been at the paper 9 months. I was night police reporter. And I think they kind of said, no, he'll come in. And so I got called in and was sent to the courthouse for the arraignment of the five burglars who'd been caught. And this is in the book that Carl Bernstein and I did, All the President's Men, in the movie version, but the judge was asking kind of the head burglar, James McCord, where do you work? And McCord would just whisper, CIA. And the judge said, speak up, and McCord whispered a little louder, but you still couldn't hear it. And the judge finally said, you know, speak up so people can hear you. So he said, CIA. And I remember sitting there in one of the front rows and going, holy S.
Yeah.
Burglars generally, it turned out he was head of security at the CIA. The idea the head of security would be caught in the Democratic Party national headquarters, burglarizing, going photographing documents, placing eavesdropping devices or trying to get them so they would work properly and so forth, was off the charts.
So that was a big story to you from the very get-go of the arraignment, which, you know, a lot of official Washington said, well, this is just typical Washington behavior. Remember, this is before the hearings about the CIA as far as their missteps. Was it sort of expected at that time or not?
Well, the conventional wisdom was, simply put, Nixon is too smart to be involved in this. And, of course, that turned out not to be the case, but that was the conventional wisdom. And Carl and I had the luxury of time and freedom from the editors to pursue every lead, and they were on us all the time. What's going on with Watergate? Where's the next story? Where is this going? And so we just followed kind of the evidentiary trail, and Carl got the names of all the people who worked at Nixon's reelection committee. We started visiting them at night and developing other sources within the government, including Mark Felt, who was the number two in the FBI, and wrote stories showing that there was a massive criminal conspiracy all connected to Watergate to cover up a much larger effort to spy on and sabotage the Democrats running against Nixon.
That's sort of the untold part of the story. We think of the cover-up of the break-in, but there was all these things going on to basically sabotage the opposition party's chances in the upcoming election.
Yes, and there is, and as the Senate Watergate Committee found, there were a whole bunch of spying and sabotage activities that actually went back before Nixon took office. It was a kind of a way of life. They hired a former New York policeman to climb a telephone pole behind the house of Joe Kraft, who was a columnist for the Washington Post, and tap his telephone. They hired people to chauffeur for Senator Muskie, who was leading candidate to get the Democratic nomination. They hired his chauffeur as a spy and One of the chauffeur's jobs was to transport documents between Muskie's campaign headquarters and his office in the Senate. And the spy, who I think was named Ruby One, they all had code names, serious stuff. There were so many documents that he had to get copies of that he rented an apartment, rented a Xerox machine. As he would go between offices, he would stop and Xerox all the documents and get into the Nixon campaign. So everything Muskie did, they knew about. And if you trace all of this out, it was quite effective, such that in the investigations, it was established 2 months before the Watergate burglary, where they got caught in April of 1972, Haldeman, Nixon's chief of staff, ordered all of the spying and sabotage activities be shifted from Senator Muskie to Senator McGovern, who eventually got the nomination.
Very interesting. My guest today is Bob Woodward, investigative journalist, associate editor of The Washington Post, author of 16 books over the years on Washington politics and policymakers. It all began with All the President's Men and the Watergate break-in, which they'll be commemorating the 40th anniversary of the Watergate break-in when he and Carl Bernstein will appear at the University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture tomorrow night at 7:30. As you spoke earlier, background sources has played a major role in the Watergate reportage, and it's easy to say. People feared for their jobs. It served your investigation well in Watergate and most of your books since, although there it's top policymakers talking on background. It allows, I guess, deniability of some of those subjects when the book comes out. But how do you tell between a plausible account and someone using you to either to settle a score or play politics?
Well, you check everything. In the case of the last book I did, Obama's Wars, on the decision-making by the president and his advisors and cabinet officers in the Afghan War, which is now front and center once again. In the book, you see exactly what they did, and I have the time that I could get notes, documents, talk to the key people, and if somebody was quoted in a meeting, I would go to that person and say, I understand you said this and that. And one of the top national security people after the book came out went around telling people, and he was asked, is the book correct? And he said, it's frighteningly accurate.
Well, in fact, a lot of times people who say this didn't happen, it later comes out, I think Henry Kissinger, about Nixon praying it in the final days, he writes about it in his memoir. And
yeah,
he denounced it at the time.
Denied it and then wrote a much more graphic, emotionally shattering portrait of that scene in his own book.
Well, one last question. You've been covering scandals in both parties for a number of years, but at least in the president administration, there's been no major scandals through the nearly 4 years of the presidency. And that seems to be some sort of record, I have to say. Do you think that's due to the vetting he did, or what exactly? A more vigilant press corps?
We don't know what we don't know.
True.
And there are people who would argue that some of the scandals, like the Solyndra money, are involved. $500 million allegedly? A lot of people would say that's a scandal, but not the kind of personal criminal scandals that we often have seen in the past.
What do you attribute that to?
You don't know, because there may be things simmering that will explode, or maybe not. And I'm sure the president would like to say it's because he had the highest standards and they had a brilliant vetting system.
And I think their campaign is starting to say that, as a matter of fact.
there's some, on the surface, based on what we know, that's true. One of the things you learn is today's truth is tomorrow's lie. And so that's what they say, and there's no evidence to contradict it in a major way. But let's see, because we was with a bunch of British journalists last night and asked them the question, which I often ask people, how much do you know about what's going on in the Prime Minister's office, Prime Minister Cameron? And they all kind of said, low percentage. And Al Gore once told me that we only knew 1% of what went on that was important or interesting in the Clinton White House.
Well, we look forward to you and Carl Bernstein reminiscing over the Watergate and its lessons for today. Bob Woodward, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.